this week's program, we take a walk through a new retrospective of the work of the 19th century narrative painter William Ranney at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Blue Ball Barn in Wilmington, Delaware, built in 1914 by Albert I. DuPont. The newly renovated building is now home to the Delaware Folk Art Collection. We explore the latest exhibition at the American Philosophical Society, and Susan Lewis considers the carillon, a musical instrument of multiple bells, most often located in church towers. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Forging an American Identity, The Art of William Ranney is the first major retrospective of the career of the American painter in over 40 years. It opens this Tuesday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Ranney is best known for his Western canvases, but he also painted portraits, hunting and sporting scenes, and historical portrayals. Besides some time spent in Texas in his early 20s, Ranney lived and worked on the outskirts of New York City and created all of his paintings in a studio. The subjects, hunters, trappers and farmers, as well as epic and historical figures like Daniel Boone and George Washington, all came from his imagination. Yet William Ranney's very studied, posed images were a defining influence on the way the public saw the conquest of the West and on how they saw themselves as Americans. This new exhibition in Philadelphia draws together 60 of William Ranney's paintings from public and private collections across the U.S. I took a walk through the exhibition yesterday morning and spoke with the curator of American art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Kathleen Foster. Aside from a short period of time in 1836, William Ranney didn't really spend a great deal of time west of the Mississippi. How did he paint these works?
He painted these works from his studio in New York or in Hoboken, from imagination, from memory. And actually, that's a powerful part of the story. He was in the West, but he came back and reimagined it from the East. And so what we're seeing is a kind of mythologized West from the view of the Eastern Seaboard.
No, or very little formal training. Started off as a portraitist. He seems to have had all of the characteristics of what we might describe almost as a hustler in this day and age.
We don't know how he picked up his skills. He may have imitated other artists. He may have had some teaching. It's just a complete mystery to us. Actually, what's so impressive is how he pulled himself together very rapidly, became a very sophisticated painter, seemingly out of his own resources.
Was he painting, as you say, just from imagination, or were there models involved, or do we know?
Oh, he certainly had models. He was using his neighbors, his own dogs, his own horses, that sort of thing. Apparently, his studio was famous for having a lot of paraphernalia in it that he used in order to establish the authenticity of the subjects. But it's certainly true that the subjects that he painted that were actually from northern New Jersey, the hunting and fishing subjects, are probably the most authentic to the period, to the location, because they were right in his backyard. The Western subjects, I think he just had a lot of traps and things that he brought back or that he managed to acquire, and he dressed his neighbors up as trappers and outfitted them from his imagination.
And in very studied poses.
Oh, in very studied. These are very theatrical paintings. In fact, you notice many of the frames are arched, kind of like theater prosceniums. Mm-hmm. You get the sense that you're seeing figures on stage, and the cowboys or the trappers are galloping off. There's always something happening off stage that your attention is drawn to. So you're thrown into the middle of a story, and you have the sense of looking into, like a movie, like a theatrical experience.
But in terms of the images themselves, they're not what we in the 21st century would remember from, I don't know, the 1950s images of the Wild West, where there were cowboys and they were the spurs and the jodhpurs and all that kind of thing. Very much of their time. But the start of that tradition, which eventually led us to the Hollywood reimagining of the conquering of the West.
This is really an earlier West, and we forget that the West before the Civil War was a different territory. Most of the Westerns that we know, the kind of Billy the Kid Westerns, are actually late 19th century, 1880s, 1890s, and those Western towns and the paraphernalia of the cowboy and the sheriff and so forth is very different than it was in 1840 for Ranney, where the West was largely unsettled, there were no towns of this type, and it was a landscape of trappers getting landscaping furs, a landscape of horse hunters who were really harvesting the wild horses from the plains, and a largely empty place with the covered wagons moving across. So Rani just knew a very different West than the ones that I think has come to populate our imagination in cinema.
And in his day, how influential was he in terms of forming people's images of what was happening beyond the eastern seaboard?
Oh, hugely influential. He was literally a household name in his day in a way that we can hardly imagine because his work was so often engraved. People belonged to art unions, and for their membership they would get a print every year. And several times, Rani's print was the one that was distributed to literally thousands of households across the United States. So these images from American history and from the settlement of the West had a very wide distribution. And people put them up on their, you know, parlor walls and learned about the West from Rani.
It's been quite a while since there's been a major retrospective of his work. Why do you think that is?
He was first rediscovered in the 20th century in 1962, and that was the last time there was a big retrospective, of the complete comprehensive retrospective of his work. And I think scholarship has gotten a long way since 1962, so I think there's a new look at this kind of mid-19th century painting now in general, not just for the artistic qualities of it, but also for the messages that are in the paintings. And I think Rani is newly interesting to us for the attitudes that are buried in these paintings about American character, about the experience of settling the West, about who we are as a nation. And so I think that scholars now, and I think general audience today, also finds it very interesting to revisit this moment in 1850 that was a very riven moment politically. The country was really destabilized. We were heading off for civil war. And yet you had an artist here who was doing his best to pull people together. So his message is one of national unity. It's a patriotic message. It's a very idealistic message. There is no irony in this. There's no cynicism in it. And so I think it's really delightful from this perspective today to look back at an artist working very earnestly to bring national harmony.
Kathleen Foster, the Robert L. McNeil Jr. Curator of American Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Forging an American Identity, The Art of William Rani, opens at the Philadelphia Museum of Art on Tuesday and runs through August 19th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The country's first state is also one of the smallest, both in population and in area. But when it comes to folk art, few states can match Delaware's dedication to the creative tradition of its local cultures. The Delaware Folk Art Collection in Wilmington is just one of three state-owned folk art collections in America and the only one to have a permanent home in a state-owned facility. WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer recently visited the exhibition, which is housed in a less than traditional gallery space.
The Delaware Folk Art Collection makes its home in an old stone barn just minutes from downtown Wilmington. The Blue Ball Barn sits on the same property where the Blue Ball Inn once stood, so named because innkeepers would hang a blue ball on a post to signal stagecoach drivers to stop for passengers. Like many historic Delaware institutions, the Blue Ball Barn was built for a member of the prominent DuPont family, Alfred I. DuPont. It was constructed in 1914 as part of a working dairy farm, intended to produce supplies for the nearby 300-acre Nemours estate. Barbara Woodford, an interpretive manager for Delaware State Parks, says the building was exceptional for its time, when barns were mostly made of timber.
The barn was built, and the techniques they used to build it were state-of-the-art in 1914. What you see is a stone barn, the metal beaming, all original. Downstairs, the cement floor, the floor of the barn was done very advanced for 1914. They were very concerned about dairy cattle and disease at that period of time. And so A.I. DuPont used his great resources to make sure that this barn was in the best possible condition for the time.
When DuPont died in 1935, the property was split up and leased to tenant farmers for decades until the barn was abandoned in 1977. In subsequent years, the Blue Ball Barn land changed hands numerous times, and the barn fell into disrepair. But when the state of Delaware took over management of the property in the late 1990s, they began looking at ways to preserve the natural and cultural history of the land, in collaboration with other private and nonprofit organizations. Out of this initiative came the 150-acre Alapacas Run State Park. with the renovated Blue Ball Barn at its core. Just as it was state-of-the-art when it was built, the barn was readapted to be a cutting-edge green building, certified by the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design Green Building Rating System. It's the first public space in Delaware to receive this certification. The design of the renovated structure and the adjoining new addition includes a sun shading system on the south side of the building, energy-efficient lighting, an advanced air ventilation system, and a rainwater collection system for water conservation, to name a few features. Susan Statz, park manager for the Alapacas Park and the Blue Ball Barn, says the old farm isn't the only thing being reused.
A lot of the materials that you find within the building itself are made from recycled materials. So, for example, all our tables and chairs are made from recycled materials. Even the office furniture, you know, has a certain amount of recycled material component to the construction of the office furniture. So we've tried to then incorporate this theory of reuse, you know, into our everyday activities.
While restoration of the Blue Ball Barn helps preserve part of the region's heritage, the centerpiece of the facility is the Delaware Folk Art Collection, which organizers started to assemble in the early 1990s. The collection features the work of 50 Delaware artists, with over 120 pieces, ranging from traditional paint on canvas to quilts to chainsaw carvings to a Native American dance stick to decorative corn straw brooms. But what makes these pieces specifically folk art? Michael Miller, manager of the Delaware Folklife Program, explains that folk art is created by people without reference to mainstream art forms, aesthetic expectations, and categories.
Folk art reflects the stuff that everyday people do because that's who they are. Very few of these artists have any training. A few do, you know, might pick up a watercolor class here or there or something like this.
As a cultural historian who was deeply involved in assembling the collection, Miller says he wanted to make sure the exhibit presented a reflection of Delaware's diverse culture and people, adhering to something he calls the culture concept.
Very few museums in the country, even art museums, present the culture concept. Typically, they're presenting a well-known artist or well-known works, kind of as standalone examples of the culture. Folk culture is very much about the people, so it's as inclusive as possible. And the idea about the culture concept is to put the people and their works in the context of their lives. So in the catalog and the labeling and things, you have statements from the artist, a little bit about their background, their inspirations.
The Delaware collection is divided into five categories based on the source or inspiration of the works. One is root cultures, reflecting the earliest cultures of Delaware. There's a new traditions category, which celebrates work from contemporary immigrants, and a fine folk art section, featuring art that mirrors the techniques and styles of fine arts, but are usually created by untrained artists. The salvage and outsider art component of the exhibit showcases works created from discarded or unconventional materials, while the art from work grouping highlights creative expressions connected to occupation, often involving a tool, product, or process related to making a living. Having a permanent folk art exhibit that's limited in scope to one geographical area, in this case Delaware, is something special. To be sure, there are numerous notable folk art exhibits across the country, but they're generally privately owned and a bit broader in scope. Michael Miller says few states have the opportunity and resources to assemble this sort of collection. They're usually put together by wealthy private collectors.
These people had the wherewithal to go out there and spend the time and meet the people and accumulate the stuff. And most states simply have not. You know, states are in the business of providing basic services to their citizens, including roads, health services, what have you. And art in the Western tradition is very much a luxury.
Miller says in an era when community connections seem to be less important, in contrast to, say, 50 or 60 years ago, when people knew most of their neighbors, folk art is one way to recapture a sense of who we are. And interpretive manager Barbara Woodford says the Blue Ball Barn does this well for Delaware.
The entire focus of this building is really about the people who worked, lived, and created the texture of the state of Delaware.
In addition to exploring the cultural identity of the state through the Delaware Folk Art Collection, visitors can also take advantage of the surrounding 150 acres of the Alapacas Run State Park, which is continually in development to include bike and walking trails, picnic areas, sports fields, a dog park, and a 23,000-square-foot playground specifically designed to be accessible to children with disabilities.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Links to more information about the Blue Ball Barn, the Delaware Folk Art Collection, and the Alapocas Run State Park can be found at our website, www.wrti.org. Benjamin Franklin founded the American Philosophical Society in 1748 to promote useful knowledge through intellectual discourse and critical thought. It was, for a time, the site of one of America's first museums, founded by Philadelphia Naturalist and Philosophical Society member Charles Wilson Peale to provide, quote, rational amusement for the public. Items were displayed in Philosophical Hall from 1794 through 1811. The American Philosophical Society revived the museum in 2001, rotating exhibitions from its extensive collection in the history, art, and science of early America. The latest exhibition at the museum focuses on five American explorers whose work spans the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. Earlier this week, I spoke with the director and curator of the Museum of the American Philosophical Society, Sue Ann Prince, about these five pioneers and the significance of their work to our lives today. I'm guessing that there are more than five famous Philadelphia explorers. Why these five in particular?
We wanted to get a range, a chronological range, and also a subject matter range. David Rittenhouse, of course, is well known from the square that bears his name, and he's well known to Philadelphians, but he's not well known to a broader population across the country or to an international audience. And that took care of the 18th century, and him being probably the most famous scientist after Benjamin Franklin, we thought he was important to do, and we have outstanding holdings. We wanted to get a range of the 19th century, which represents the stereotype of an explorer, people going off to unknown regions, the Arctic or the Antarctica, and taking off on long sailing voyages. So we did two of those, Titian Ramsay Peale, who was on the United States Exploring Expedition, and Elisha Kent Kane, who went to the Arctic. Also in the 19th century is, of course, John James Audubon, who is known for his artwork, but we also wanted to focus on him as an explorer because he didn't just do this in the studio from other pictures or from specimens that were brought in. He actually went out into the field and tromped through thousands of miles of wilderness. So we wanted to look at him as an explorer as well as an artist. And in the 20th century, we wanted to do someone where we could look at exploration in a little bit different way than we did in the 19th century, not someone who went off to the moon, like Neil Armstrong, who was also a member, but someone who did field work. And instead of discovering new rivers, for instance, Ruth Patrick looked at rivers that have already been discovered, but looked at them in new ways by studying the pollution levels in the rivers. So we wanted to honor her as well, because she turns 100 this year and is also a member of the society.
What do you want visitors to take away from this exhibition?
I would like visitors to leave here with a lot of excitement about what these people have done, because these are people who had a vision or had an idea or had really the courage to go out there and to test their ideas or to go out there and explore waters that had never been explored, to go clear, to take 4 years of your life, go out all around the world. I think that people can learn from looking at what these people do.
And the founder of this institution, I'm guessing, would be pleased with an exhibition such as this, which of course feeds into many of his different interests.
Yes, Franklin would, I think, be very proud to see these objects displayed.
Director and curator of the Museum of the American Philosophical Society, Sue Ann Prince. Undaunted, Five American Explorers, 1760 to 2007, runs through December 28th. Bells have played an important part in the history of civilizations. They've sounded the time of day, called people together, announced the opening and closing of stock markets, marked events such as weddings and funerals, and functioned as civic alarms during times of trouble. Eventually, bells were also used for music, and that tradition continues today. WRTI's Susan Lewis went to the top of three Philadelphia area towers to investigate the carillon, a musical instrument made up of many bells.
The ringing of bells is common enough. But not all bell sounds are made the same way. There are swinging bells and stationary bells, electronic bells and super bells, or rather, sets of bells played together on an instrument known as a carillon, played here by Lisa Loney for a recording at Longwood Gardens. A carillon is most often at the top of a tall tower, and there's only one way to get there, whether you begin from a center city square.
It's a lot of steps, and it gets narrow and tricky.
On the streets of a city neighborhood.
1798, the church was founded. 1796, I think.
Or on a leafy suburban hillside.
I love these stairs because they're worn from people going up and down it since the 18-somethings, 1880s.
At the top of the tower, anywhere from 23 to 77 stationary cast bronze bells are suspended on a large frame, often in a partially enclosed bell chamber. Each bell clapper is connected by a wire to what looks like an organ console, sort of. The keys, instead of ivories, are wooden handles called batons, and a carillonneur, like Lisa Loney, based at St. Thomas Whitemarsh, doesn't tickle them with her fingertips.
They're struck with the closed fist or the open hand. The lower bells, which may be a little bit more difficult to play because you're moving a clapper that might be about 500 or 600 pounds, are played with the feet.
The bells themselves are even heavier. Above the bustling streets of the Germantown section of Philadelphia, carillonneur Janet Tebble takes us up the steps from the playing room into the actual bell chamber of the First United Methodist Church.
Watch out, don't bump your head or bump your feet and go over there.
So we're walking under this giant bell. How big is this bell?
About 1¾ tons.
1¾ tons?
Yeah. This baby over here is 3½ tons. This is called the Bourdon, B-O-U-R-D-O-N. It's a French word that we borrowed. It means the lowest bell of a set of bells.
Tebble speaks with pride and affection for these bells she plays.
So I love being up here because of all these big bells. Now, we have 5 bells that are bigger than the Liberty Bell. Our 5th bell is the size, is the Liberty Bell. There's the Liberty Bell over there. That's an E-flat.
Because bells vibrate in circles, and a single bell with its curving profile produces a tone and various overtones, each bell in a carillon must be in tune with itself, and then in tune with the other bells, which also have to be the same profile, or shape and material.
Otherwise it would be like playing a melody plucked on a viola and tooted on an oboe and blasted on a trumpet. You have to have a style that matches and the same mix of bell bronze and the same profile of bell and everything else.
The result is an instrument of great power played with a lot of physical activity. Here's what it sounds like from up in the tower when Janet Tebble plays Sparocchia by Jeff Rotiers. Lisa Loney finds playing the carillon quite a workout.
The hands are flying, the feet are going at a rapid pace, and we're usually working up the sweat. It's not pretty to watch, but it's, I think, a really beautiful instrument from the ground.
From the ground is where we usually listen to the bells, and carillon recitals are inevitably open-air events. Learning and practicing, by the way, for the sanity of the neighborhood, takes place on a practice console not hooked up to the bells. The music, even of a familiar tune, is distinctive.
And if you think of an organ in an orchestra hall, the organist stops playing, he lifts his hands, and you have that very slight decay of a couple of seconds as the sound reverberates. With the carillon, you have enormous decay. And that's going on and on and on. So when we either arrange for carillon or compose from carillon, we have to be very cognizant of that decay and that we don't have dissimilar notes crashing in on each other.
Carillons date from the 1500s in the Low Countries of Europe, mainly Belgium, Holland, and northern France, which, along with England, are still where most bells are made. Janet Tebble says bells were extremely important to a town.
And if a king wanted to show a town that they had fallen out of favor, they would take away their bells. And during World War II, when the Germans came in and took a lot of the Belgian and Dutch bells, that was just a horrible, horrible insult. And many bells were secreted away in the middle of the night and sunk down into canals and dug down into crypts, and we're still finding them, actually.
Carillons became popular in America in the early 1900s. From its beginnings in Europe and through the years, repertoire evolved, from folk tunes to music composed specifically for carillons to contemporary compositions and arrangements in many styles, including jazz and pop. Today, Lisa Loney says the Delaware Valley tri-state area, including Princeton and Longwood Gardens, has the largest concentration of carillons in the United States. The Church of the Holy Trinity on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia has the oldest manually played carillon in North America. Organist and choirmaster John French says it was installed in 1882.
The bells were cast in Belgium. They were inspected by a very famous Victorian composer at the time, Sir John Stainer, who passed off on the bells and pronounced them healthy and a good set.
Carillon playing had a revival in the early 20th century. Although it's not the easiest instrument to build, install, and maintain, Loney says her repairman comes from the Netherlands. Today, carillons do exist all over the world, including relatively new ones in Japan. Some carillons, like the one at Holy Trinity on Rittenhouse Square, have the option of electronic mechanisms.
15 years ago, the bells were in a state of disrepair and really could not be played. The bells were actually taken out of the tower and refinished and restored, and the tower was, you know, put into good shape. They were also modernized at the time so that they could be played mechanically as well as being played manually, since we don't have somebody who goes up to the tower 3 times a day to play the instrument.
Although for most people, it's not a full-time gig. You get the sense that running up there is part of the fun of being a carillonneur.
And I love being up above the city, and I know that it's been like this since 1927, and then I have buddies all over the world who get to hang out in carillon towers, too.
I'm above the tree line. It's just being inside your instrument that you play. I think it's kind of heavenly. I don't know. It's really great. I like it a lot.
There is clearly joy in this pursuit close to the heavens, making what is perhaps the ultimate musical public art, connecting with tradition, with these massive bells, and with the world on the ground. A carillonneur never knows who might be listening, whether they plan to or not.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Summer carillon concerts in the Delaware Valley will feature local musicians as well as carillonneurs from France, Portugal, and Japan. The first United Church of Germantown's concerts begin this Monday and run for 4 weeks. The 5-week concert series of St. Thomas Church in White Marsh begins on July 3rd, while the Church of the Holy Trinity on Rittenhouse Square features live carillon music before selected Wednesday evensong services. And you can find a link to complete listings of summer recitals at our website, www.wrti.org. And that's our program. Our special thanks this week to David Trombello, Elizabeth Smith, and Elaine Wilner. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.